morning, UW Extension friends, and welcome to the Wisconsin Horticulture Friday Update. I'm George Kep, ag agent from Columbia County, located in Portage, Wisconsin, where the north begins. At least we like to think so here. It's where the Wisconsin River kind of continues heading south and west, and then the Fox River begins heading north, so that's where that north begins stuff all came from. If you're in Portage sometime, it depends upon where you're at and where it's raining as to whether that drains to the Fox and heads north out through the St. Lawrence Seaway into the Atlantic Ocean, or does the raindrop fall to the south and head to Wisconsin and ends up down in the Gulf of Mexico. So our water can go one of two ways pretty quickly up here. So anyway, welcome again, and I'd like to go through the county roll calls if we could, and why don't we go ahead and do our county reports as you report in, and we'll go ahead and we'll start with whoever's here from the southern region.
I don't know if that includes me, but Marquette County, Melissa here, and so far this week we've kind of had a couple questions on grapes on a couple of just general not thriving, and then also a couple of questions on tomatoes. I've got some samples actually sitting on my desk right now waiting to get sent in to Brian. So.
Okay, great, thanks. Anybody from the southern region here yet? Are they bashful? Not here? And we'll skip over to the western region then.
Oh, southeastern region, does that work? Or?
Oh, we'll take southeast.
Are we there?
Even.
This is Sharon from Milwaukee County, and we have gotten lovely rains. I emptied an inch of water out of the rain gauge between Monday and Thursday, and we've probably gotten almost another inch since yesterday morning, probably. So we're doing great with water. In fact, a little too much. We have root rot problems, lots of them. We have leaf spot diseases. Japanese beetles are down. We don't have very, very large populations. They're building a little now, but it has not been bad yet this year. It's more like talking about what we don't have. We don't have Colorado potato beetle. We didn't have any of that. Very, very minor. Spotted and striped cucumber beetle. I haven't seen any of them. We did have a lot of squash vine borer. We have, as I said, a lot of the leaf spot diseases have been pretty severe. Septoria on Rudbeckia and coneflower and root rot. Other than that, we also have a lot of new discoveries of emerald ash borer. So that's about it.
All right, good. Anybody else in that East Metro area of the state?
Hi, George. This is BJ from Bronx County. Most of our calls are still focused on Japanese beetle this week. Interestingly, last week we thought that the population was winding down, but it doesn't seem like to be. We've seen cases where the Japanese beetles were decimating even the apple fruits, actually. So it's been quite severe here on certain pockets of Brown County this year. We are also noticing squash vine borer, as well as squash bug. Powdery mildews on multiple stuffs, actually, from cucumbers, pumpkins, and zinnias and other plants. Noticing some few tree disorders and some grape anthracnose on fruits as well as on leaves and on stems.
All right. Thanks, BJ. Anyone else, East Metro?
I guess that would be me. This is Jill with Outagamie. I don't have a lot to add, but we are having a lot of signs of spots on maples that hopefully are not going to be the fatal kind, and a lot of weed IDs.
All righty. Anyone else, East Metro?
This is Kim with Winnebago.
Welcome.
It's been fairly normal week, nothing too bad. Calls are still coming in. They're across the board. We have some weed IDs, how to control weeds and lawn, especially crabgrass. People are starting to notice all the crabgrass. We're still getting calls on anthracnose, on your ash trees, flower IDs. We've had an unusually high number this summer of black knot questions coming in, and we've had the first case of blossom end rot coming into the office, so we'll probably start getting more calls here soon on tomato problems. But that's about it here.
All righty. How about anybody from the central area?
This is Sophie from Portage.
Welcome.
Thank you. I've seen a lot of powdery mildew, a lot of it on Norway maple, sun scald on peppers, some dead bee reports, dead bird reports and a lot of reports on zucchini and peppers and tomatoes not producing fruit. And that's about it.
All right. Anybody else? Central region. Jump to the north. Anybody from the real north with us today? Okay. Any others that have just kind of stuck in on us? All right. We'll move on then to the specialist reports. We have any other specialists?
You didn't call up the West yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thought I did. Okay, Western region.
Yeah, so this is Heidi from St. Croix County. I'm calling in for both Diana and I today. And just the fact that we haven't had any rain here for a really long time, it's not just the horticulture crops that look really bad, but the field crops are going down as well. So we're in a really bad drought situation here with no rain expected till Sunday or Monday. So we're seeing Japanese beetle populations increasing. I'm seeing quite a bit of increase in my garden now compared to where we were a week or two ago. And we've had SWD has been confirmed by a commercial grower in Pepin County. I've got a lot of calls coming in about evergreen dieback, and not sure if it's going to be from the white pine weevil or if it's mostly probably from the drought situation that we're in. They went through drought last fall, through the winter. Spring we got a lot of rain, and now we're back into drought again, and so it's stressing them out quite badly. So I'm getting most of my calls are probably about white pine and evergreens dying. And then I've seen a few calls on maple, as others have seen. And then I am getting a couple calls on blossom end rot, mostly in container tomatoes, because people, I think, are drying them down and doing those wet-dry cycles on them. So trying to give them some advice on even moisture on those. The other thing I'm hearing is squash vine borer or bacterial wilting in squashes. We're trying to figure out what's going on with people's squashes as they're wilting. And that's about it.
All righty. Any other agents or counties that haven't reported in yet this morning? Okay, then we'll check with any other specialists that are online this morning.
Well, Phil's on.
Okay, Phil.
First of all, Kim, if you get a chance after we're done, I need to have a conversation with you. Nothing
okay.
big, but it's something, some information I need to pass on to you.
Okay.
The spotted wing has kind of exploded as Chriselle had gotten the stuff out, both seeing adults coming in from all over, and a lot of the larvae are small, and what one presumes is the next generation is going to be coming on pretty quick, and that's when it's really, I think, going to explode as far as fruit infectivity. Other than that, kind of a constant little bit of this, little bit of that, there's nothing that really has got my attention as being very special, but yet I'm still running. I outdid last year by 100 samples, which feels strange because it doesn't seem that buggy, but yet, boy, a lot of stuff has come through the lab. But as I said, it's a little of this, a little of that. And so I guess I'll just open it up to questions.
Yeah, Phil, this is Kevin and Spooner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we just sent you a sample spotted wing Drosophila question, so we need your... I guess I was wondering, do they look different when they're not quite fully mature than when they're full adults?
Well, you can get some color differences, and that gets people confused sometimes. But, I mean, ultimately, the two biggies are the male with a very distinct spot, and for the female, until I see the egg-laying device and how distinctive it is with the teeth, that's where I jump to and forget everything else as far as color. But, yes, when they first emerge, they tend to be lighter, and then they darken up a little bit over time.
Okay. Well... the samples were sent yesterday, so you'll get those whenever.
Okay.
This is Sharon in Milwaukee, and I know I haven't been on the line for the last couple of sessions, but just very quickly, Phil, your impressions of Japanese beetle this year around the state?
Well, in the areas where it has been well established and experienced the drought, they're very low. But for people like BJ, where we're still on the first 4 or 5 years of infestation, they're pretty bad. I got the... a picture last week out of Black River Falls area of a gentleman who was just getting hammered. And so that's been kind of the experience, is that the areas that where we seem to getting under some kind of natural balance and then the drought on top of it, I think the numbers are very low. But as they said, in the areas where it's relatively new, and I think VJ had a little bit more moisture than we did, they're just experiencing what nasty Japanese beetles are like.
And... so in Milwaukee, we do have very low numbers, so we can attribute that to somewhat of a natural balance, you think, or is it more related to the drought?
I think the drought has a major impact, but, you know, so what I would expect, if I had to predict for next year with this more lushness that we seem to have, is a little bit of a bump up of the population, but I just, watching it for 12 years in Madison and in my area, is, you know, we're at about 10 to 15% of the population we were when we were at the heyday, and I live close to a golf course, so there's no reason, if there wasn't a balance going on, there's no reason for this population reduction other than And this is something that has been seen in other states. It's that big push, and then, as I said, it drops considerably. Chris Williamson's got a couple really neat research pieces going on. They're working with a BT formulation that is sprayed to kill the adults. You know, and normally BT kills larvae, but it appears to be very effective, and so that's quite exciting on the organic side for people. The other thing that PJ was telling me about is a little mechanical device that a guy has come up with that you attach to the stem of the plant, and it shakes the plant on a regular basis, and literally the beetles fall off. You know, they just don't like the disturbance, and although that's still in the development stage, you kind of wonder if that technology might work for some other insects that, again, would defensively respond by dropping off the plant if there's a vibration. So stay tuned on those.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, any other specialists with us right now?
Hi, George. I'm back on.
Oh, okay. Great, Brian. Well,
I just have pretty much two words for the week, and that's oak wilt.
Okay.
Lots of and lots of positive oak wilt samples this week. So it's very active. A little bit of verticillium wilt. We've seen some crown and root rot on a raspberry, and I think you should have gotten a report from me on the ones that no, actually not. Those are still pending, but those look like root rot as well. But we've had raspberry samples from all over the state that have root rot issues.
That's the Phytophthora brand?
I've seen a range of things, some Phytophthora, some Pythium, some Rhizoctonia, so it's really varied from site to site.
Okay, anything producers can do to help themselves out?
If it's commercial, there are fungicide options, and I have outlined those. For Rhizoctonia, that's pretty untreatable because there are certainly products that are out there that will control Rhizoctonia, but they're not labeled for use oftentimes on fruit crops, at least not raspberries or things like strawberries.
Okay. And mostly they've got to hit that in the spring before they get the problem, correct?
You could apply at this time of the season, but I like to target those applications to periods where it's likely to be wetter because that's when these organisms tend to be active.
Sure. All right.
And my recommendation, if Rhizoctonia is really bad, it would be to reestablish a new patch, and that's with new plants, new location, new plants, and make sure soil drainage is really good.
Okay. Well, good. Anything else?
Any questions for me?
Well, Brian, you may remember a sample. This is Sharon from Milwaukee. That
yeah.
was sent in by one of our master gardeners, Peg Lewis, and it turned out to be, on her Shasta daisies, turned out to be Fusarium is what she found.
Okay.
And you recommended fungicide control, but the fungicides are difficult to find. They're mostly only
yep.
available to...
Yeah, you'd have to have a commercial person come in, typically, and apply those.
Now, she went to one of our well-respected garden centers around here and was given a recommendation of using copper.
No, not for something like that. I don't think that would work that well.
I didn't think so either. And I was just kind of surprised that there is a fungicide to use for Fusarium, too.
Well, if you've got some of the root rot Fusaria, then there are some products that you could use. Now, if it's one of the vascular wilt pathogens, which it would not, I wouldn't have made the fungicide recommendation if that was what we were seeing.
Oh, so those
I wouldn't recommend fungicides for.
There's different types of Fusarium that...
Yeah, there are many different species, and some tend to be more root and crown rotters. Others can be vascular wilt pathogens.
All right.
And some of them aren't pathogens at all. There are lots and lots of different species of Fusarium.
And the root rot type Fusarium is, like, aggravated or favored by the wet conditions we've had.
Yep. In general, root rots are more of a problem when it's wet.
Yeah, I understand that, but I never thought of Fusarium being really dependent on that. But if there's different types of Fusariums, I've been thinking of the vascular wilt type, so
mm-hmm.
I guess that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, even the vascular wilt pathogens tend to be more active when it's wet. Fungi in general dislike wetter conditions typically. That's kind of a very broad generalization, but that's generally true.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
All righty. Any more questions for Brian? If not, then we'll move along, and we'll visit with our special guest today. We want to welcome Mark Dwyer. He's the Director of Horticulture at the Janesville Rotary Gardens. We welcome him, and he's going to talk to us a little bit today about some shade perennials. Mark, if you would just share with us a little of your background and some things about your job duties and description and responsibilities there.
Absolutely, and a pleasure to be involved with this, and thanks, everyone, for listening. Of course, if you doze off, I have no way to monitor that, but that's fairly typical with most of my presentations, so no, I don't take it personally. Now, I've been at Rotary Gardens now for 15 years. Rotary Botanical Gardens down in Janesville, Wisconsin is a 20-acre nonprofit botanic garden dedicated to international peace and friendship. And for those that have visited, you've seen a lot of different thematic gardens here, Japanese garden, English cottage garden, at various styles. Our mission, however, is to promote horticultural education and appreciation for everyone. I'm involved with the education department. I pretty much take care of a lot of what's happening out in the gardens, and I can't say enough about volunteerism here. With our 20 acres, we're so reliant on volunteers, and as I speak, we have a good dozen or so out in the gardens right now. We also had some decent rain last night, almost an inch, so we're real fortunate, quite a change from a year ago. My background is in landscape architecture and forestry, and I've worked at a botanic garden prior to being at Rotary Gardens. So public horticulture and plants are my true love. And, of course, for those that have come to the gardens, it's lots of fun to plant different themes and different colors. And I was asked earlier about how things are looking, and I'd say they're at peak right now. We have a huge orange theme and lots of great things going on. Our collections include, currently we have about 900 varieties of annuals. It's about 150,000 plants. And doing a lot of trialing. We have a collection of close to 3,000 varieties of perennials, big collections of ferns, daylilies, and hostas, and our woody plant collection's a little over 1,200 taxa. So lots of things shoehorned into this 20 acres. But, you know, enough about that. I hope you will visit. And I've done a daily, almost daily gardening blog for 5 years now. And if anyone's interested, if you Google Rotary Gardens blog, you'll get to it, and you'll see pictures of what's happening day to day. Now, I know the topic today is shade perennials, and I think most of you have downloaded the presentation or the sheet with the different images. And, of course, to do this topic in 30 to 40 minutes doesn't do it justice, of course, but we're going to touch on a couple things and not necessarily new plants. I'm always wary of just promoting things that are new and not trialed, and I think we know in the industry there's a lot of things that come down the pipe that aren't sufficiently trialed, and they're simply eye candy in catalogs. And I think the adage that all new plants aren't good and all good plants aren't new really holds form, particularly in the shade, because there's a lot of old standbys and plants that do very well. But I think the most important thing I'll emphasize isn't going through a list of 400 or 500 types of plants that will do well in shade. It's important to determine what shade really means, because for your general public and those calling in with questions, when they say, I've got a shady area, what can I plant, that should elicit a dozen more questions, because it's certainly not a simple answer. And as we go through these plants, we'll talk a little bit about how to ask some of those questions, and I'm sure we've all dealt with it in our home gardens as well. And, of course, we'll use examples of what's happening at Rotary Gardens. This is my first time on a phone-based presentation, so I if anyone has questions, I think I'll hear if you jump in. Otherwise, I'll certainly leave some time at the end to discuss these. The first slide, with the title Shade Perennials, that's one of our shade gardens. And here at Rotary Gardens, there are a lot of existing shade trees, cottonwoods, hackberries, granted some fairly messy trees, but we're very fortunate to be able to demonstrate plants that will do well in shade and part shade situations. And I never say that there's certain plants that will thrive in shade. I think we know dry shade is a real challenge. And in many cases, the plants we're putting in shade are simply shade tolerant and will do well. And, of course, again, soils are a big factor as well. But let's we'll go to the next slide. The first consideration, really, how much light is available. That light intensity, of course, differs throughout the day and also the growing season. And when I hear individuals say, well, it's kind of partly shady. Well, to me, partly shady can mean a lot of different things. And, you know, think of our plant tags when they're sold. They have those three symbols, an open circle for full sun, a dark circle for shade, then half and half. And we know there's not three gradations of shade. There's really countless gradations of shade. And for us, part shade, if you're getting morning light, is a lot different than part shade if you're getting afternoon light. And that's also different from dappled light and bright indirect light. So, again, knowing the exact lighting conditions will help in dictating some recommendations. But we'll get to soil shortly. I think soil is certainly the most important consideration and really what can these people do in their gardens in terms of watering and keeping up with these plants. I always say we tend to be reactive with plant problems. We see plants that aren't doing well or thriving, or not thriving, they're getting thirsty, they're just not performing. So much of that goes back to the consumer being proactive with research and understanding the needs of the plant. And I've used this comment many times, and that's simply the fact that these plants, you know, we have an expectation of these plants to do well. Let's say in our shade garden, we spend a lot of money, we install these plants, and we get upset when they don't do well. All those plants have a reverse expectation of us, and that's to know that plant and know what the plant needs. Because, again, all too often plant failures relate to something that could have been controlled or considered by the homeowner or consumer prior to installation. Back to the slide, again, that light can be quite variable, and that is a consideration. The next slide, kind of a grassy area with some overhead canopy, you know, that yard changes considerably during the course of the day. A lot of bright light in the morning, a lot of bright light in the afternoon, dappled light in the midday. So, again, they're able to grow turf here, and all too often we hear conditions of, hey, I can't grow anything under this red maple or this shallow-rooted tree. And that's another beast to tackle, the idea of what plants will thrive in those drier shade conditions, which really to me is one of the most challenging spots and certainly one of the toughest spots we have here at the gardens. Next slide, I talk about soil issues. This is an image of my brother's yard in Medina, Illinois. This is a Chicago suburb. The tree trunks you see there, there's an elm and then there's some spruce. Notice some tulips in the foreground finishing up. There's such a root congestion in there, he can't hardly grow anything. And, you know, he's put in some hostas and some other plants that he thought might do well. And what we're doing, you know, my question for him is, what are you willing to do with the soil? I mean, can you keep it irrigated? Can you keep it wet? And would you consider some organic amendments, some sort of compost, something to enrich the soil, but certainly not affect the soil level, which thereby might affect those trees? And over the years, he's slowly amending the soil and improving it, and he's able to start incorporating some plants that can tolerate that root competition, perennials such as pulmonaria, lungworts, hellebores, the brunnera, the false forget-me-nots. And I'll show samples of all those plants, and I know many of you are familiar with those plants, and much of this talk will be preaching to the choir. But all too often, if my brother had called me and said, hey, I've got this shady spot, what can I put in there? I really would like to see an image like this and ask some questions and know a little bit more about the site. And for him, it's been a 5 to 6 year process of finally getting some decent growth in there. On the flip side, next image, there's a reference to Olbrich Botanical Gardens, a wonderful botanic garden in Madison. Everyone certainly should visit. This is in one of their little shade gardens, and there's been a lot of soil improvements going on in this shady nook, and the ability to grow very lush, heart-shade-tolerant perennials. You see hostas and ferns. Lots of goodies in an area that has had oak leaf mulch added to it for many years. So a very rich soil for these plants and doing well. But keep in mind that all perennials don't prefer ultra-rich soil. In many cases, a homeowner may say, I don't have the ability to amend the soil. I may have to deal with what I have here. So what can I use? Of course, the plant palette expands exponentially in a situation like this where the soil is quite nice and moisture retentive. Next image, selection factors. On the left, there's an image of a hosta and a maidenhair fern. In selecting these perennials, again, it's knowing the plant and understanding its needs. What is the preferred light intensity of the plant? I mean, first of all, what does it really like and prefer? Also, what will it tolerate? And that image on the left was taken in quite a shady situation, but I guarantee those hostas and the maidenhair ferns, you wouldn't plunk in a Christmas tree farm or an area or with an overhead canopy of evergreens where there's really no low layer of plants simply because of lack of light and lack of ample, the rooting competition. So again, there's these plants are in a partly shaded location where they are getting some indirect or partial lighting. What's the preferred soil and pH of those plants? You know, what makes these plants happy? And that makes sense. We preach that to everyone. You know, happy plants need to be researched, and that's vital. The preferred moisture regime for those plants, is it an area that'll be fairly dry and has a lot of root competition? Or is it an area that's already been composted or has a more moisture-retentive capability? What inputs are involved with nurturing that plant? Are there special needs for that plant? And the homeowner would like to know that. You know, all too often they plant something that becomes challenging, perhaps a plant that tends to spread a little bit or is quite vigorous or becomes taller than they anticipated, maybe a plant that requires some deadheading or some other inputs for a proper appearance. And again, knowing that ahead of the game is important. So knowing the plant, obviously, is vital. So jumping to some plants for shade, and again, the conditions are knowing the conditions for each of these becomes important. I've given 3-hour talks on shade perennials and barely scratched the surface. So you're going to see a lot of things in this talk, but you're going to see a lot of things that aren't included. And again, they all fall into that palette of what we should be considering. But again, I'm shying away from a lot of these newer plants until I've trialed them. And I get real concerned about hardiness issues. And as a pseudo trial garden here at Rotary Gardens, we are trying some of these new plants, but we're not real quick to recommend them, whether it's my presentations or verbally, until we've had a couple years under our belt with each of these plants. Of course, Canadian ginger has been around a long time and is a great ground cover. You're seeing the heart-shaped leaves. The flowers are at ground level. You see those in mid-spring. They're kind of a neat maroon ground-level flower. But this wonderful heart-shaped foliage tends to be a matting perennial. We have it throughout our Japanese garden where we do have a moderate amount of dryness. We don't have irrigation through that entire garden. So, you know, Canadian ginger does fairly well. However, in the drought last year, it shriveled up very quickly and went dormant by midsummer. It just shut down. It wasn't real happy. But I love this as a ground cover. And the next slide, the European ginger. Nice glossy leaf, smaller leaf. Also, the flowers are low to the ground. Slow-forming clump, but real beautiful with that sheen. And all too often, you know, foliage is vital. And we all know that as we get into shade, I tell our visitors, you do become more reliant on foliage textures, foliage colors. And yes, flowering in the shade is possible, but it's all too ephemeral. It's very, very quick. It tends to shy on the side of spring, typically with a deciduous overhead canopy. Those gardens we call shade gardens in summer may receive ample spring light where spring flowers are more prevalent. So going back to the importance of foliage, I think we all know that, whether it's in shade, sun, annual compositions, or a container. And this European ginger, I think, shows its merit in the shade garden. The next image, if you're not familiar with barren strawberry, Waldstenia, there's two species that look near identical. This was a shot at Chicago Botanic Garden in an area of almost entire shade. It's a very nice mat former. In fact, once it colonizes, and it does colonize, it doesn't stop. You have to keep that in mind. It keeps going. It eliminates almost all weed competition. It's very tough. Has a beautiful yellow flower in mid-spring, and again is a great mat former. And it takes again, a lot of shade. So keep this one in mind. But again, with ground covers, which could be a separate topic, there's no ground cover out there that's just going to stop. And unfortunately, there's a prevalence with these ivies and vinca and pachysandra, all having their own merit, that are just overplanted. And I think something like this has a little more merit. Next image shows a close-up of the flowers, which are strongest in mid-spring, and then you'll see sporadic blooms throughout the rest of the year. But again, Waldstenia is a great plant, and we've planted it in our toughest shade and part shade areas that are not irrigated. So it's also quite drought tolerant. Next image, the false forget-me-nots. Boy, there's been a real surge in new varieties. Of course, they get their name from the beautiful blue flowers in spring, which last about 2 weeks and then disappear. This is the old variegata you're seeing here. Nice variegated foliage. The other nice thing about Brunner is not only their partial shade tolerance, and I'll back up and say I would never put them in deep shade. They'll grow, but they just don't thrive. And I think with dappled light or indirect light or morning or afternoon light, they do quite well. I avoid full sun with Brunneras because they can get crispy, and just about every variety will get a kind of a crispy edge by July and August if not properly irrigated and in full sun. But Brunneras and part sun love it, and this is an old variety. Again, the combination of flowers and foliage is nice, and then that foliage carries the interest through the rest of the summer. But the developments, Jack Frost has been around for 6 or 7 years now. This is my favorite, this silver patina with the green venation. Also has the blue flowers in spring, but absolutely beautiful. And going back to what I said earlier, when you have a partly shaded location, this silver glows. It really adds a lot of color, and at dusk, when you think about a moonlight-type garden, this Brunnera really shines well in low lighting as well. So Jack Frost, to me, is a real keeper. And now there's 4 or 5 varieties that look identical to this, including some that are like a Jack Frost on steroids, huge leaves looking very similar to this. Regardless of the variety, I think this silver patina is a winner. The leaves are like sandpaper, so we've seen no deer browsing. On occasion, we'll see a little hole peppered through here and there. Not sure if that's earwigs or maybe a slug, but for the most part, the leaves are clean throughout the summer. And there's next image is a close-up of those beautiful flowers that you'll see in late April into early May, and then they just disappear. Next image, there's a nice clumping of Jack Frost. It's great as a specimen plant or as a grouping. And going back to ground covers, you saw Wildstenia earlier, and I made reference to mat forming or creeping ground covers. There's nothing wrong with putting a lot of clumping plants together to create a pseudo ground cover. And in this case, there's four or five of these Jack Frost Brenneras planted in close proximity to form a ground cover. And who cares if it's, you know, shin high? This is something that's effective, and combined with ferns and hostas, the Brenneras are real keepers. Next image, looking glass. Love this one. It's almost a pure silver leaf. All the same merits and benefits that you saw with Jack Frost, but this silver patina is even more effective. And in spring, it just glows. Ours out in the garden, we probably have 30 or 40 specimens of this. They all look top-notch right now. We tend to put them in soils that have been composted, but Brenneras in tough soils do okay, but they will benefit from a little organic matter, and infrequent deep watering certainly help as well. Last year was so telling with many plants, and when we saw Brenneras start wilting and shutting down, we realized there is a limitation to its drought hardiness, and I think many of us experienced that last summer. Next image, a relatively new variety, King's Ransom. And what's nice about this is you have the benefit of the silver patina, like Jack Frost, and you have the lime highlights, particularly in spring. So if you look along the edges of the leaves, you have kind of a lime offering to those leaves as well. So I call it kind of a chartreusey Jack Frost, and to me looks different enough from Jack Frost that it's worthy of consideration, but that chartreuse is most predominant in spring. But a good variety, and there must be 20 varieties of Brenneras out there now, if not more. One of the best collections of Brenneras I've ever seen is out at Chicago Botanic Garden in their old trial gardens. Next image, I alluded to pulmonarias or lungworts earlier. This is Silver Shimmers. There's dozens and dozens of varieties of lungworts, and they have some of the same merits that I mentioned with Brennera. These are very deer-resistant because of the leaves. They're very, well, again, like sandpaper, very fuzzy and not a soft fuzz at all, but quite rough in texture. Pulmonarias are great in spring, mid to late April. They'll send out these blue or pink flowers. Some varieties have white flowers. Some have raspberry-colored flowers. Unfortunately, the flowers are really only a 2 to 3 week gig, and then the leaves take over. And you saw my brother's yard earlier. He's growing some great pulmonarias in that area now. They tolerate dry shade, although they do prefer a little more rich soil if you can provide it. And mulching certainly doesn't harm these at all either. Most will be under 12 inches tall, and they're a slowly expanding clump. But for adding that wonderful coloration in the shade garden, they're dynamite. And pulmonarias run the range from solid green leaves to solid silver leaves, silver-edged, silver-centered, silver-spotted. You see silver shimmers here, and you're seeing a start of what those leaves are going to do with that speckling. Pulmonarias have been around a long time, and I think they're a real stalwart go-to plant in the shade. I can't remember ever removing a dead pulmonaria here, and we've got hundreds. Next image, an example of a totally silver pulmonaria. Diana Claire, beautiful. It's already done flowering, and in this case, combined with some impatiens kind of speckled through the gaps, very effective. And on occasion, again, we'll see some leaf holes in these, like I mentioned with Brunnera. Not sure what the culprit is, but for the most part, the leaves are relatively untouched. Might look a little bedraggled in a dry year by the end of summer, but this is the type of plant we'll put under those shallow-rooted maples or under our cottonwoods at the crest of berms where it tends to dry out the quickest. And I'm not saying that they need no water, of course, but they take a lot less water than most of our other shade plants and tough as nails. Next image, another great silver leaf called Samurai. And I'm, again, scratching the surface with pulmonarias. Samurai is great because it's very narrow leaves, very long leaves. And when I talk to people about pulmonarias, I say, yes, do consider the flower color, but keep in mind that's 2 to 3 weeks in spring. You have to select them for their foliage and use that as a tool. Now, imagine this at dusk in your backyard. This silver will glow and is another great contributor. Next image, hellebores. This is Blue Lady. Hellebores have seen a resurgence over the past couple years. I can't keep up with all the breeding and all the crossing of species and great varieties. They're being bred now for more upright flowers. I think many of us who can grow hellebores know they have that beautiful foliage that tends to be untouched by insect or diseases. Of course, the flowers are quite early, but tend to dangle downwards, and they benefit from a position on a wall or somewhere where you can really see the flowers. But as a plant that'll take relatively dry shade and not deep shade, but partial shade to moderate shade, hellebores for us are just absolutely dynamite. One of the best hellebore collections, or the heaviest use of hellebores, is at Olbrich that I mentioned earlier. If you go through there in April and May, you'll see some really neat things, including Blue Lady. We probably have 100 specimens of hellebores, and they all do very well. Next image, I'm not sure of the variety here, but what I wanted to show was that foliage. In our climate, it's considered semi-evergreen. Essentially, those green leaves will go through the winter. They'll get covered with snow. They may appear somewhat green, sort of brown in spring, and we trim those off as the flowers emerge, and new growth will recover and replace that. Can't get enough of hellebores, and when I use pulmonarias in that drier shade condition, I also include hellebores. Back to my brother, he's doing the same thing, pulmonarias and hellebores in his shady area. Next image, the Lenten rose, or Christmas rose, rather, Helleborus niger. Here it is, this year, this is a shot taken in late March, early April. Last year was so darn early, I took this picture on February 1st. Warmer climates, it comes up earlier, but this hellebore blooming well before foliage is even seen. So a real harbinger of spring, and one of the first things we see out in the gardens. You'll see a lot more hellebores in the garden centers, and I do promote them as really tough plants. They do well in a wide range of soils, but not in the heaviest of clays. That excessive moisture can be an issue. So how many times do we hear moist but well-drained? That applies to hellebores for optimum growth for sure. Next image, another neat variety, mellow yellow. We probably have 20 or 30 varieties, lots of different specimens. We use them as clumping ground covers, lots of them in close proximity. And the flower interest is nice because the flowers starting in, say, March or April, depending on how the spring's going for us, extend and have some color changes, but offer interest for a good two and a half months before they fade, and then the foliage is a nice glossy contributor in the part shade garden. We don't put hellebores in a lot of sun. They can actually, they're quite sun tolerant with adequate moisture, but without adequate moisture, you start to see some crispiness on the leaves. Next image, another variety, Pink Frost, one of our earliest blooming varieties. So again, the flowers are beautiful. I'm taking advantage of some low-angle shots here. So again, most of these are drooping downwards, but I'm excited to see future developments with more upright blooming hellebores. Next image, the simisifugas, or snake roots. They're blooming right now. This is also called fairy candles. This is a shot taken at Berner Botanical Gardens in Hales Corners over near Milwaukee. Wonderful garden to visit as well. This is in their little dell garden, their little glade beneath that waterfall. And talk about a great plant for flower architecture. These candelabras of fragrant white blooms. And I'll back up and say the fragrance is subjective. Some people like it. Some people think it smells like rotten soap. That's up to you. But the simisifugas in general, racemosis starts blooming in July, well into August, and has some great height to it. Now, simisifugas are very dependent on moisture, and rich soils will benefit them greatly. We've seen a lot of those simisifugas with the dark leaves, black negligee, brunette, some of these brown or deep maroon leaf simisifugas bloom later in the season. They're typically a late September to October bloomer, also with white flowers like this. Keep in mind that while simisifugas are shade tolerant and part shade tolerant, those dark leaf varieties get their best foliage coloration in more sun. So a brunette, which is a deep maroon leaf simisifuga in a shady condition, is really greenish. Still gets the nice flowers, but brunette in more sun with lots of water, it gets darker. The best stands of dark leaf simisifuga I've seen are in full sun at the Chicago Botanic Garden in very rich soils with lots of moisture. So simisifuga will also take quite a bit of sun. So here's a case of a plant that has a shade tolerance, but again, if you're getting one for foliage, keep in mind that sun brings out the best coloration. We plant these in tight groupings because we like that tall look with these upright spires, and we'll plant 12 to 15 plants in close proximity. We can get these up to 4, 5, 6, and even 7 feet easily. Next image, Corydalis lutea. Now, I don't know further up north if you can grow this, but the Corydalis, or yellow fumitory, if you look closely, it seems reminiscent of a bleeding heart or a columbine. Nice bluish-green foliage, beautiful yellow flowers. And whenever I'm asked what perennial for us has the longest bloom period, this is it, because it's blooming for us from late April all the way to the hardest of frost. It's self-cleaning, so it just keeps blooming. If you've grown it, you know it does like to spread by seed, so it'll start to colonize an area. And in our case, in our shade gardens, we let it do its thing. We let it kind of fill in the gaps. And it's easy to edit or weed out or cull. But again, lots of bloom power over the course of the season. Now, this will not do well in deep shade, but in part shade, any degree of part shade will do very well. Only about a foot high, but it's a great, again, filler between shade perennials. Should be hardy to zone 5. I've heard of it in zone 4 as well. You don't have to buy 12 of them. You buy one or two, and then you let it do its thing. So another great plant. Clean foliage through the entire growing season. Next image, Dicentra Candy Hearts. Really a miniature bleeding heart or western bleeding heart. This is one of the eczema-type Dicentras. They tend to not only bloom strongly in spring but have sporadic blooms through the rest of the summer. This is a real close-up of the blooms, and who doesn't like bleeding hearts? And I love our old-fashioned bleeding hearts. However, right now the foliage is yellowing, and we're cutting those down. As they go dormant, you can leave that foliage up or cut it. However, I like these small ones because the foliage doesn't go dormant to very late in the summer. It tends to be very lacy. And again, those sporadic blooms offer punctuation through the rest of the summer. Again, peak bloom in May for these. But there's oodles of varieties of these dwarf Dicentras. So keep them in mind because typically when this is blooming, the overhead canopy, let me back up and say its strongest bloom is when the overhead deciduous canopy hasn't filled in. So it's getting plenty of light before it finishes that strong wave of bloom. Next image, Dicentra Goldheart. Here's a golden leaf version of the old-fashioned bleeding heart. So you'll have to decide if you like pink with bright gold or chartreuse, but the foliage of this is just dynamite. So think about the size of a mature bleeding heart, getting, say, 3 feet tall, 3 to 4 foot wide. This thing having gold foliage has the benefit of not only the blooms, but that gold foliage extends all the way into its dormancy, which is now into late summer. And again, you have the choice of cutting it back or not, but it's shrub-sized and offering gold in a partly shaded location. I don't put Dicentras in full shade. I put them in part shade, and I always make sure that they have rich soils. Next image, Heucheras or coral bells. I'm not going to talk a lot about coral bells because I think we all know, we see the eye candy catalogs where there's over 500 varieties now, and that's no exaggeration. And they're coming out very quickly. And most of the images we see with these fancy ones are taken over on the West Coast where the lighting's nice and there's some real vivid colors. We know most of our Heucheras will go through color variations with the leaf. They'll look different from spring into summer. I never tout them as a shade plant. It's a shame to see them in the shade sections at nurseries. They really prefer more light. So ours are in part sun or even full sun with adequate moisture. All I'll say about Heucheras is we're really into these villosa types. Mocha, as you see here, is a villosa-type Heuchera, and that species is known for larger leaves, larger height, and a lot more tolerance of our summers. Our hot Wisconsin summers are really tough on Heucheras, particularly if they're drying out and not getting the moisture they need. And I'm comfortable saying at Rotary Gardens, if we planted 500 Heucheras in the past 10 years, there's 70 left. We lose more than we maintain, and a lot of it's proper siting. And again, I think a lot of these newfangled ones, there's a lot of winter heaving, and they're just not handling our summers real well. They're just not happy. So Heucheras need to be happy, and for the sake of a shade garden talk, they really should be in the brighter parts of shade or on the sunniest part of a shade garden as possible. Moisture, again, being a vital factor. Hostas could be a separate talk. Next image. Some in substance. We all know this variety. Great for large leaves. You know, how many varieties are there out there? Rotary Gardens is a national display garden for the American Hosta Society. We only have maybe 500 varieties, which is tip of the iceberg, but love hostas not only for leaf color, leaf shape, leaf texture, also now for fragrance and flower. And hostas are being bred now for colorful scapes or stems. And again, the breeding is amazing. And we have plenty of hostas, and I think we all know it's a go-to plant in our shade gardens. We have a lot of issues with slugs here in Janesville, as many of you do as well. We've used Slug-O as a product, and we're using something else now. I can't remember the name, but we apply our slug control 3 times over the course of the summer, trying to avoid that machine gun bullet hole appearance for our hostas later in the season. So our hostas are fairly happy, and in our richer soils, they do very well. Every 3 to 4 years, we divide most of our hostas and have a little sale as a fundraiser. So hostas are great for our beginning gardeners, and never underestimate the merit of a good hosta. They're not ubiquitous. I don't think they ever will be. I think I'm preaching to the choir. Next image, here's First Frost, and I won't spend any time describing these varieties. I think we all know they offer merit. here in a partly shaded location at Olbrich, those leaves in that pattern catches the eye as well as any flower would. So again, that reliance on foliage is vital. Next image, goat's beard. Remember what I said about Simus diffuga earlier, the snake roots. Goat's beards can take some shade, but they need really moist soils. In dry summers and dry springs, they'll go dormant very quickly. If they're not happy, they will turn brown and they'll shut down, like an astilbe will. This is in a sunny location in our sunken garden, and the straight-up Aruncus dioicus, topping out here at 5 to 6 feet with these astilbe-like blooms, is extremely happy. This soil has been amended with mushroom compost, which is mainly horse manure, lots of overhead irrigation. Again, overhead irrigation isn't the best thing, but for us, it saves us on a dry summer. But a very happy plant in a moist condition. However, there's a lot of smaller versions of goat's beard. If you go to the next slide, you see Misty Lace, which is a hybrid. This tops out at 30 inches. So we have the nice, beautiful blooms in mid to late spring. Bloom time is about 3 weeks. Even when these blooms turn brown, I think they have interest. Whether you decide to deadhead these, cut them off, or leave them, Misty Lace at 30 inches is a good mid-height Aruncus. Again, moisture-dependent. Next image, Aruncus athusifolius. This is a dwarf goat's beard. Take a look at that foliage. Very fern leaf in appearance, so top-notch in terms of its foliage contribution. Beautiful blossoms in late May. And again, we line our shade garden paths with this. It's a great edger, not only for the flowers, but the foliage, which carries the interest through the year. You just can't let these darn things dry out. So those genera of Simus diffuga and Aruncus are and so important with moisture in the shade. Epimediums. This is my third in terms of a dry shade perennial that I recommend. You've already seen pulmonarias. You've seen hellebores. Brunneras to a certain degree, but epimediums, or barren warts, also called bishop's hats, wonderful clean foliage. We've rarely seen issues with epimediums in terms of any insect or disease problems, and they're, to me, three seasons of interest. You get a nice tinting on most with the spring foliage, beautiful spring blooms, very orchid-like in appearance. The blooms are fairly ephemeral, 2 to 3 weeks, but most will get a fall tinting as well, sometimes very late in the season. Epimedium rubrum, very common in garden centers. This is a spring shot. Notice this beautiful tinting, which I think offers a lot of interest. Go to the next slide. That's an extreme close-up of the blossoms, which are really only half inch in diameter. I'm at ground level, by the way. These tend to arc downwards. They come up on short wands, but there's multiple flowers that arc downwards. Epimedium rubrum is an old standby, does very well. Once these blooms finish, though, the plant is extremely solid and is also one of those great clumping ground covers. Does very well in masses, and again, has extended interest. The next image, this is a shot taken in November. And it's up to you to decide if this is interesting, but I mentioned late fall color for epimediums. Here's Epimedium rubrum. Some years it's a more brilliant red. Here it's kind of a rusty red. And they'll hold their leaves all the way into winter. And similar to hellebore, many will stay semi-evergreen, and then you trim that growth off in spring. Clean them up, and you'll get new growth and new flowers. Next image, here's an epimedium called Pubigerum, used as a massing ground cover. So here it is after it's bloomed. Notice there's still some tinting on the leaves. And here's a case where you could have selected the Waldstenia we saw earlier, any other ground cover. Hey, but why not 50 clumping epimediums? Once they fill in, weed control is established. They help shade the soil. They're a living mulch. Very effective. We have about 40 varieties of epimediums here, and that's scratching the surface. There's a lot of great types out there. Most are hardy to zone 3 or 4. And they're underutilized. People should certainly select them for flower, but also their utilitarian use in the shade and part shade. And here's that Pubigerum flower up close. Beautiful orange. Look close. You'll see a whole bunch of ants on there, on those flowers. And I'm assuming they're part of the pollination process, but again, epimediums are tough as nails. Going back to what I said about pulmonarias, we've never removed an epimedium that's died. I mean, they last forever. They don't expand real quickly. They're not the easiest to divide and relocate, but they are tough. Next image, just showing you some of the great flowers. Again, these are close-ups. Here's Mars, beautiful orchid-like blossoms. And the next image, grasses and sedges. Now, I know Ed Lyon a couple weeks ago spoke about grasses and sedges in the garden, and I'll go through this very quickly. But in the shade garden, you have to keep in mind these grass or grass-like plants offer texture and color. In this image on the left, that's Bowles Golden Sedge. And on the right, that's the Golden Hakone Grass. Hakone Grass might be tougher for some of you up north. slow-growing grass, hardy to zone 5, although in a protected climate it should do okay. That carex or sedge on the left could take zone 4. But here, both of these grasses, and sedges, of course, aren't true grasses, but closely related, but regardless, they're offering texture and color along this shaded edge. Next image, that Bowles golden sedge in a close-up. We use it throughout our fern garden. We have a huge fern and moss garden with about 250 varieties of ferns. You know, a lot of green. So we punctuated it with this sedge to offer not only texture, but the bright gold blips in the garden. Next image, Carex pennsylvanica, a native from really out east. I'm not sure if it's native to Wisconsin, but in this case used at Olbrich. It has a wonderful ground cover. Notice the path leading through the center, but tell me that doesn't soften up the space and offer an effective use of a clumping carex. Now, with sedges, that carex genus should always raise flags when you're recommending them because there are some running sedges, and I'm always wary of the descriptions that say, vigorous with an exclamation point. And to a consumer, that sounds pretty good. Why wouldn't you want a vigorous plant? Well, spreading sedges are near impossible to control, and we've had some horrible instances here at the gardens, some regrets with running sedges. So be wary of know the species and know its growth habit in terms of clumping or running. Next image, that Hakana Kloa. If you look on the left, lower left, tell me that doesn't brighten up a shady location. Notice the blue hostas in the back, and then to the right, there's that Mocha Coral Bells you saw earlier. At Olbrich, this is a nice image in a partly shaded location. Only gets afternoon light. You're just starting to see the late afternoon light sneak into this space. Notice there's no flowers. Going back to an earlier comment, the reliance on foliage is vital. And here it is in spring with hellebore in the background. I'm looking at my clock here, so I'm going to keep going. I know you all have busy days, but I want to make sure we get through this on time. Next image, there's that all gold Hakana Kloa, also along an edge, softening a pathway. And there's many varieties of this golden Hakone grass, and I'd say there's probably a good 15 varieties now, some known for fall coloration, most known for interesting foliage, whether it's striped white, striped yellow, or solid gold like this. Ferns. Ferns are great in the shade garden. Be wary. Know your fern. Here you're seeing Matuccia or ostrich fern, one of our great natives, 4 to 5 feet when it's happy. Also a spreading fern. It's a rhizotomous fern that really likes to take over some real estate. So in some conditions, like this setting here, may be appropriate. But in a garden setting, people should know it's that gift that keeps on giving. Next image, ferns as a ground cover. You're seeing maidenhair fern in the lower right. In the central area of the slide, there's some Japanese painted ferns that I'll talk about, offering not only function by covering space, but texture and color. And those Japanese ferns are just amazing. Who can argue that maidenhair fern doesn't offer great texture in the next image? Hardy to zone 3. There's also Adiantum aluticum, which is Alaska maidenhair fern, hardy to zone 2. Despite their delicate look, they're very tough and top out usually around 24 inches. Next image, one of the best native ferns for slopes and erosion control. This is Christmas fern. Gets its common name because it's evergreen through the winter. Of course, it gets new growth in spring that replaces that. Used to be used for Christmas decorations years gone by. But a great fern, again, for deep green coloration and can take a lot of tough sites. And again, it's a great in a woodland slope for erosion control. Next image, sensitive fern, Anaclea. Great plant, particularly along wet roadsides or streams, tends to colonize and create a nice patch. Called sensitive fern because as soon as it sees 40 degrees Fahrenheit, it turns yellow. It's very sensitive to frost, but really a nice fern. Next image, Dre's dagger. This is one of those ferns that's a hybrid, but essentially it's a type of lady fern that has a crisscrossing pinnae. The leaflets essentially have a pattern that offer interest. So again, a lot of ferns are very green, but select those that have a little bit more interest with the pinnae. Ferns need to be happy, of course, and a lot of that's moisture issues and soils. Not a lot of ferns will take dry shade. Hay-scented fern is one that might take it, but most of these need the moisture. Here's Fresiliae or tatting fern. Looks a little like parsley on a stick, but real beautiful as a 12-inch tall, 12-inch wide fern. Great clumper, nice in a repeated pattern. And the painted ferns. Was perennial plant of the year from the Perennial Plant Association years ago. Great silvering of the pinnae, burgundy stems. And most will get in that 12 to 15 inch and do very well. We like to put them in part sun. And keep in mind they get their best coloration after a couple years in the ground. Many times people will say, hey, my new Japanese painted fern doesn't look real good. We say, give it a year or two. There's many varieties of painted fern. our fern collection, we have about 30 varieties, and I'd say about half of them look identical. And it's very difficult to identify differences, but I'll point out some that I think that have merit. Next image, Silver Falls, is a selected variety that has a high proportion of silvery. So here's a 15-inch tall fern with a lot of silver punch in the shade garden. Again, moist soils will benefit this. Really a beautiful fern. Japanese painted ferns get their best color in spring when they emerge and tend to have more burgundy and then go to the silvers as they head into June. Next image, here's Samurai Sword with a great combination of burgundy and silver. And again, can't say enough. If you do visit the garden, do see our fern and moss garden, and these are all side by side. You'll see some interesting differences. Next image, Burgundy Lace, tends to have a lot of maroon to the pinnae. So whereas Silver Falls is mostly silver, Burgundy Lace is mostly burgundy or maroon, as is Pewter Lace in the next image. That's a spring shot, so you're seeing a lot of maroon in that shot. Next image, Apple Court, a crested painted fern. So the pinnae, you look at the end of the pinnae there, they fan out in crest. So you still have silver and maroon, but a little more of a punch with that interest. So fern aficionados think that's pretty cool. And whether you like it or not, this Apple Court is becoming very popular. Ghost Fern. They've now crossed painted fern with lady fern and are coming up with some great taller ferns that offer the benefits, the hardiness and height of a lady fern, but the silvering of the painted fern parent. Here's Ghost at Olbrich in Madison. This is a mature specimen at 24 to 30 inches. So here we have a painted fern on steroids, essentially. Can't say enough about this hybrid. Great plant. Next image, another lady slash painted fern hybrid. Branford Beauty, also offering that silver patina on a taller fern. Next image, Branford Rambler. And I don't know why this one is greener, but it is greener. And as the term or the variety name Rambler should indicate, it does start to take up some real estate. Not rampantly, but does start to become a mid-height ground cover. Still has a little silvering to it, but not quite as much as Branford Beauty. Next image, Ocean's Fury. Here's a crested lady fern painted fern hybrid. So 24 inches tall. Little hard to see the cresting, but great plant for interest and texture in the garden. Keep in mind that silver offers so much. And mosses, you know, our moss garden has a neat area, and I can't identify mosses at all. There's 400 native species in Wisconsin alone, so I think very few can identify them. But the benefit of mosses in the garden as a visual, not as a ground cover for walking, but as a ground cover in general. This is a garden in Waukesha, the garden of Dale Sievert, and this guy makes you think you're in the Pacific Northwest. Next image, he's doing a neat sort of Japanese garden feel with punctuated rocks. Tell me that wouldn't sell people on the benefits of moss. And people will say, hey, under my maple I can only grow moss, and why can't I grow turf? Well, the area is not conducive to turf, it's conducive to moss. So maybe go with it and understand moss never displaces turf. Moss, it takes advantage of low vigor turf areas. So we just collect little smidges of moss at Rotary Gardens and we do things. This is also Dale's garden in the next image. Next image, in conclusion, I'd like to say, you know, that's a smattering of shade garden perennials, and I think it's important to not only keep in touch with what's happening with what garden centers are offering, but talking to your constituents on what's doing well and why is that happening. So that proactive research with knowing the plant is, to me, is number one in the equation, but asking more pointed questions of what shade really is for these people and what it means in terms of their maintenance regime and what they can do in those locations. I apologize for the whirlwind presentation. I have this fear that somehow I'm disconnected and talking to no one. But at this point in time, George, I don't know, do we have time for questions?
Yeah, I think we can run a few minutes if people have questions. Not a problem. Any questions at all out there?
Can you say where again? Oops, sorry.
Oh, that's okay. With hellebore, I put in a couple this year. This is Jill from Outagamie.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just not doing anything. I mean, there's like a couple leaves, and that's it. So I don't know if they're in a place that gets morning sunlight for a couple hours,
mm-hmm.
in fairly good soil.
Yeah, you know, with hellebores, and I apologize, I should have mentioned this. When we put in a new hellebore, whether it's a 6-inch pot or a gallon pot, the first year they don't do much. Second year we're like, okay, they're doing all right. The third year is when we tend to see them really establish. So based on your verbal description, the site sounds fine. I would just be a little patient. And once they get established, they form a nice clump. They're not fast growing, but once they establish, it's a perennial you never have to divide. I mean, you can just leave it there, and it'll live 50 years. It's like a peony. You know, it's there. So hang in there. I think it'll do all right.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Another question out there?
Can you just say again where the moss garden was at that you had the pictures from? Because I think my master gardeners might be interested in that eventually.
Sure. The moss garden is in Waukesha. The gentleman's name is Dale Sievert. And if you get on the Rotary Gardens website and track down my email, go ahead and email me, and I'll send you his contact information. Dale renovated our moss garden here, and I wish I'd shown a picture of it, and it's dynamite. He was actually here yesterday. But he's welcomed Master Gardener tours to his garden, which is a one-acre. It's unreal. And it's not just moss and shade. It's unbelievable. And he's a retired professor from MATC, and he that's all he does is garden, and it's spectacular. So contact me, and I'll get you in touch with him.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Sure.
All right. Any last questions for Mark? If not, thanks, Mark, for your great presentation. Really enjoyed that. And personally, I can see that if I need to gain some husband points here in the near future, I need to get my wife down to Janesville to see some of the work you've got down at the garden. So I will certainly put that a little higher on the list here.
Wonderful. Open invitation to everyone. We hope you'll come visit.
Okay, sounds great. Again, thanks for your information and great slides there.
Sure, my pleasure.
Any final reports or announcements from people online today? All right, hearing none, then thanks everyone for participating. I see that Patty from Racine is up to host next week, and I hope everybody has a great weekend, that you get rain if you need it, and that you don't get rain if you don't need it. And hopefully some of you can sneak off to the state fair, too, if you get a chance. Always a fun time down there.